Right, okay, so this talk, that it's actually a very simple story I'm going to tell here. We just started working on this like 3 months ago, and within a month we produced a paper, which is to say we found, we identified a mechanism to saturate R-mode, at least in stars that have crust. So my collaborators here is Chris Messner and Phil Arras, which is sitting here. Phil promised to correct me if I say anything wrong, so I'm pretty safe. We all come from CEDA. Okay, I guess by the end of the conference, I don't need much introduction to say why we want to do this. So I just briefly mention two things, which is amplitudes of armor, which is related to the direct detection of the gravitational waves, and amplitudes of armor also determines, by the time you add to the instability strip, what kind of frequency, spin frequency you have. So we have two cases, which is low mass X-ray binaries and young neutron stars. I just noticed that the people here who are astrophysicists are always talking about young and low mass X-ray binary, and people who are GR always talking about young neutron stars. I don't understand why it's a dichotomy. Okay, so my talk will just have two parts. Right. Well, you get data from LIGO. Right. Okay. This is made in Britain.
Oh, be nice. Be nice.
Right. Okay. So it's one very simple point in terms of saturation amplitude. When you want to find the saturation amplitude, you first find a linear driving rate for the mode in the star. And then you find, or try to find one way, one nonlinear dissipation rate for the mode. And you equate the two, that gives you the saturation amplitude. The saturation amplitude we identify in neutron stars is solely to do with this effect that eta is not zero. Eta here is this slippage that Greg has talked about this morning. Just at the bottom of the stellar crust, because of the restoring force has a discontinuity, you naturally expect certain discontinuity in the motion of the two parts. So there's eta there, which is non-zero. What happens when you usually have such a velocity discontinuity? So this is actually real data, shows that if you have, in the Earth's atmosphere, if you have clouds, sorry, if you have air moving this way, and air moving this way, energetically, these two parts of air will try to mix between themselves and equalize the velocity to minimize energy, which means you start have one type of instability called the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. And this is just a representation of the linear growth stage of such a Kelvin-Helmholtz wave. So you happen to have a layer of cloud here, luckily. So you can see the waves growing because the cloud is just kind of passive marker for those waves. And the lower panel is the artist's conception of what happens when the Kelvin-Helmholtz wave develops, keeps on developing. What happens is that the wave's going to break. It's going to cascade into a smaller and smaller scale. If you allow sufficient time, you're going to have full-scale turbulence in this region. And that's going to... what that's going to do is that it's going to transport momentum between the two regions and at the same time dissipate the kinetic energy, converting into heat. I suppose the biggest worry in people's mind is that when you talk about turbulence, what do we know about turbulence? What can we say? In this case, it's actually amazingly fortunate in the sense that turbulence is quantified by one number, and that number has been both measured, has been theoretically simulated, and has been theoretically derived. So that's this number, drag coefficient. Yeah, if I write a stress between the two layers of material, two layers of matter on each other, the stress is force per unit area in a dimensional form. So this take care of the dimension. And this is the dimensionless number. So this is the velocity discontinuity I just talked about. You can measure what the CV is, drag coefficient is, in realistic flows. For example, this is one of the plots presented in these people's paper. What they do is that in experiment, they have a tank with a big flat surface, and there above that, there's just a water flow periodically rubbing the tank. So they can measure the drag. You can see that the two types of dependencies of the drag coefficient on the Reynolds number. The Reynolds number in this case is just defined by the relative velocity times the relative displacement divided by the molecular viscosity. Okay, I'll explain two branches. First branch, this branch, the dependence of CV on the Reynolds number or on the amplitudes of the oscillation is such that when you look at the drag, the force is basically only proportional to velocity to the first power. That's it. This is the normal viscous boundary layer result. However, when you have large enough, sufficiently large Reynolds number, in this case it's about 2 by 10 to the 5 or so, the dependence of CD on Reynolds number changes character. It becomes a kind of logarithmic dependence. It's not very obvious here, but it's really logarithmic. Logarithmic dependence on the Reynolds number, which has the significance in the sense that the stress, the force that's exerted by the fluid on the plate depends on velocity to the square power. It's kind of a well-known result, except here they actually give out what the CD is at the transition of laminar to turbulent region, and the CD is about 5 by 10 to the minus 3. Okay, what's important about this is that, oops, when you look at the energy dissipation rate, energy change in this turbulent region, which is just the stress times the velocity integrated over the surface of the integrated surface of the plate, you find out that the energy dissipation is proportional to alpha cubed. At the meantime, in neutron stars, we have the energy change, energy gain by gravitational radiation is proportional to alpha squared. That gives us a saturation. I just go through one derivation again, just show the same point. This is another way of understanding why is this turbulent dissipation is nonlinear. So if you write the turbulent dissipation in terms of Landau-Lipschitz way, the velocity gradient square times turbulent viscosity times density, because the turbulent viscosity is afforded the mean velocity of the eddies times the thickness of the layer, because that's the biggest eddy, which is transporting the momentum most efficiently. So because turbulent viscosity depends on velocity square, actually, if you just go through such a derivation, you find out the energy dissipation rate by turbulence is exactly proportional to rho times delta V2 cubed. Actually, the D does not come in, although you could derive what D is given the velocity jump. D doesn't cancel? Oh, sorry, there's a square here. Okay, so when you write down such a saturation amplitude using what other people have derived about gravitational radiation, that's what you get. So frequency, spin frequency here, we use normalized with 1 kilohertz, and CD, we use this nominal number at the onset of turbulence. And it's much less than 1 for the cases that we've considered. Okay, I'll describe later on what cases we consider.
What does the Reynolds number turn out to be here?
The Reynolds number, you can see that it's just proportional to So Reynolds number is proportional to alpha squared. It doesn't come in the sense that once the Reynolds number is sufficiently large, the drag coefficient does not depend on the Reynolds number, except the logarithmic. That's the same thing as saying that this saturation amplitude does not depend on the stellar temperature, except the logarithmic dependence in Reynolds number, and except the fact that the Reynolds number depends on viscosity, and viscosity depends on temperature. Okay, the other thing is... Yeah, I'll talk about it later. Yeah, I will have that case. Yeah. If you write the Reynolds, because critical Reynolds number is about 2 by 10 to the 5, you can actually figure out, just using this, figure out what's the critical amplitude above which you could have turbulence, above which the transition to turbulence occurs. And that's this number here. And typically, we found that the saturation amplitude is bigger than the critical amplitude, so that's self-consistent. Moreover, when the mode, whenever it becomes unstable, we just keep on growing to alpha saturation and just remain there. The significance of alpha saturation bigger than alpha critical, is nothing but saying that the energy dissipated by turbulence is bigger than the energy dissipated by the viscous boundary layer. So we have such a condition that viscous boundary layer is much thinner than the turbulent boundary layer and much thinner than the stellar radius. This turbulent boundary layer is derived just using... turbulent boundary layer is related to the velocity amplitude, and you can derive it from the... Yeah, it's proportional to alpha, actually. Yeah. So whenever this alpha keeps on growing, this becomes turbulent boundary layer.
1 meter for alpha equal to?
Just take, I just took this number, 3.5 times 3. Yeah. Which means whenever you have a saturation amplitude, the turbulent boundary layer dissipates much more heat than the viscous boundary layer. That's the first inequality means that. And the second inequality means, when turbulence is occurring, the heating due to this dissipation is very local. And that's the same as what Ben has discussed. In fact, he gave more or less the same solution as we did in terms of what the temperature profile would be in the star, inside the star. So forget about this part first. We want to know how the temperature is as you go into the armor instability region, how the temperature evolves. To do that, we sort of have this equation, which is saying the thermal content of the star changes. Well, actually, it's an integration. It's determined by the loss of heat by neutrino and the gain of heat by turbulence. In our study, we just take this term to be zero to study at any given frequency, spin frequency, what's the temperature of the boundary layer, given that the star is saturated with the alpha saturation. It looks more or less like what Ben drew earlier, that you have a, suppose this is the radius going outward, and this is the temperature of the background star. You would just have one layer that is heated up to very high temperature. We call this the boundary layer temperature, TBL. And on both sides of this boundary layer, temperature drops off with a length scale, two different length scales, in the crust size, L crust, in the core size, L core. You can write down the energy conservation energy conservation equation like this. This is the neutrino loss inside the boundary layer itself. The boundary layer is more or less isothermal within itself because the turbulence can transport, can mix the material sufficiently fast. This one interesting result is that the length scale if he goes through these two derivations, saying that the flux going to one region has to be dissipated. So say the flux going into the core, say, has to be dissipated by neutrino emission, has to be lost by neutrino emission in this region. So that's what this relation is saying. And this is just thermal conduction with conductivity that's proportional to 1 over temperature. So if he goes through these two relations, you get that the length scale of heating, of significant heating, is proportional to boundary layer temperature to the 1/4 power. And we found this length scale, just as what Bannon has found. Bannon and the collaborators found this length scale is much short, much thinner than the radius of the star, which means if you use isothermal approximation for the temperature evolution of the star, you get the temperature that's lower than the one here. Also, two other things is it's likely you won't see any surface heating due to R mode because of this L crust. It's much smaller than the thickness of the crust. Okay, so that previous transparency, just what that gives us is boundary layer temperature at given spin frequency. So with that information, we can just plot out the evolution of R mode of the star once it enters the R mode instability. So what happened here is frequency of the spin in Hertz and boundary layer temperature, not the stellar temperature. Okay, what I draw here, this curve, is the instability curve determined by laminar, determined by viscous boundary layer with this slippage unity. There's another slippage, I'll talk about this later. And this line, solid line here, is just this relation. A given spin frequency, what's the boundary layer temperature? So we call this line equilibrium spin down line. That's because any star that is evolving towards the hotter side, whenever it hits this line, it has to go down along this line and exit the instability strip at one place. Even if your young neutral star coming in at this part, as long as it's saturated by the same mechanism we just discussed, it will go along this line and exit the instability strip at the same place. In this particular case, it's 490 Hertz. I marked some typical timescales for one particular limit cycles of low mass X-ray boundary. The reason it has to go through a limit cycle, say the star spins up and then heats up when the R mode gets unstable, and then go along the equilibrium spin down line and then cool down. This limit cycle is because it's the thermal runaway effect, basically discussed by Yuri Levin last year. Okay, so the time scale shows that even with such a reduced alpha, the alpha is much less than unity now, you still only have about 100 years of R mode instability, and the duty cycle, compared this with this, is 10 minus 5, and still kind of dismally small. Right, what if eta is small? When eta is small, remember the original formula is such that the saturation amplitude is proportional to eta to the minus 3. However, because the limit cycle, the low mass X-ray boundary has to go through, it's also lying at lower frequency now. So the alpha for low mass X-ray boundary, at least, are not much different from the 3.5 by 10 minus 3 formula. I mean, does not depend on eta as strong as eta minus 3, because the frequency also gets lower. So it's still much less than unity. But for young neutron stars, things may be different. How many more minutes do I have? Nobody's taking care. 10. Thanks. Okay, the last point I will make is melting of the crust. Suppose we have a melting temperature lying here. This melting temperature is derived for crust that has a composition Z, mean charge per nuclei about 20. So presumably appropriate for low mass X-ray binary and for young neutron star will be somewhere here, I suppose. So you see that some of the limit cycles will hit with means the crust may get melted. And when the crust is melted, a lot of things becomes possible. We don't know what happens when the crust is melted in terms of the final final spin frequency. We can only conjecture what happens. And this is one of the possibilities that we can imagine that happen. So what happens is that, suppose this is a low mass X-ray binary, it's evolving to the right by the heating of the R modes. Once you hit the melting line, what happens is that the bottom part of the crust will start melt, and so the boundary layer moves up, and the higher part, the upper part, keeps on melting, and so the melting front moves up in the crust. In the meantime, however, because of the layer that is heated by the turbulent dissipation is very thin, you could imagine the layer that is the original bottom of the crust can get cooled down, sufficiently cool that it recrystallized. So that was one possibility, is a kind of onion shells. Onion shells, and you have a crust melting above it, and below it, the crust reforms, so the melting front moves down to the original bottom of the crust. And at this way, alpha is maintained at the saturation amplitude, and the crust never really get completely melted. But the temperature in that region remains about T melt. So you sort of trickles around. And once you hit this equilibrium spin down line, however, you would just go along it instead of keeping along the spin boundary layer. Because at this point, the turbulent dissipation, turbulent heating, cannot maintain the boundary layer to be at the temperature of 10 to the melting temperature. So you go down your additive instability strip at the same frequency as before. So basically, the melting doesn't quite affect what happens in the end. For the young neutron star, just as Ben has talked about, it's much more complicated. So I wouldn't go into it here. But just summarize my talk by saying the main story is turbulent viscosity can be generated by the R modes at the bottom of the crust by itself, and that is depends on the mode amplitude, non-linearly, so you could find the saturation amplitude. The spin down now takes about 100 years, independent of the initial frequency. That's because most of the spin down times actually spend near the minimum frequency. In terms of the neutron star evolution, there are only a couple points which saying there is one equilibrium spin down line, which is derived assuming the temperature is at, assuming T dot equals zero, assuming the temperature time derivative is negligible. This equilibrium spin down line, I should emphasize, you could derive for any saturation and saturation mechanism, and the neutron star will always, with any saturation mechanism, you always find such an equilibrium spin down that line, it will always go down along that line and intersects the instability curve at a fixed place. This unique terminal spin, in our case, is about 490 hertz for eta equals 1. I will emphasize two big uncertainties, which means future work. One is eta. Greg and Yuri's are doing really good works on that, and perhaps they can pin down eta and tell us how to evolve the star inside the instability region. The other uncertainty is crust melting. If the crust is completely melted, what is the next alternative saturation mechanism that can be used? Yeah, that's it.
Sort of hoping they'd say, explain why the Reynolds number for the turbulent object
You can actually, the Reynolds number they define, that's the interesting thing. They define the Reynolds number. It's not the usual way to define Reynolds number, but the way they define it is such that they can easily measure it. Okay, and there's actually a very strong physical reason why the Reynolds number has to be there. That is, if you think of turbulent cascade, it's there's a different reason. Right. The Reynolds number is the critical Reynolds number is such that the laminar, the viscous boundary layer becomes, sorry, turbulent boundary layer becomes of the same size as the laminar boundary layer. In fact, when things become turbulent, turbulent boundary layer has to be much larger than the laminar boundary layer because otherwise viscosity would dominate. So you won't have inertia dominated turbulence. So that is the condition D equals delta. And D is related to the amplitude of the mode. Why Reynolds number has to be always? If you look at, I know what you mean. Right, that's just the definition. Yeah, just because you use delta C rather than D. Say the normal way is using D here for certain fluid, like pipe flow or something. You use D here rather than the. That's it. Yeah, they just use this because they can't measure D, but they can measure relative displacement, and they are proportional anyway. Water, yeah. The things are pretty incompressible in the armor motion. Is that what you're talking about? Stratification doesn't, that question, I'm not sure stratification is the same as compressibility, but stratification I can answer, which is saying you actually have this Richardson criteria. The Richardson criteria is saying if you want to have Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, which is the progenitor of such a turbulence, you need to have, you need to have, you need to have this Richardson number, which is defined by the Brunswick multiple solutions. Right. So Richardson number, Brun square divided by dV. So this is how the stratification will come in. So whenever you find that things become turbulent because the critical Reynolds number is achieved, and then you have to come back and estimate. And we found out this dV over dz, this velocity shear in local shear is much higher than the stratification, which is about 100 hertz or 500 hertz. And the other criteria, which I haven't pointed out, is you should also estimate how the turbulent eddy turnover time compared to the mode period. And it has to be much bigger, has to be much faster, and that's also satisfied. Yeah. Turnover time is just d over delta v, and d is about meter, and alpha omega r. So 10 to the minus 3 is 10 to the 3. This is 10 to the 6. Turnover time is 10 to the minus 6. 10 to the minus 4. second, yeah. Yeah. If it's determined by the same hydrodynamical equations, the only thing that matters is this dimensionless numbers. So that's what we use if they're the same equations. I have to think about the compressibility because it's not. Yeah. Right. But the question is if it's sonic or supersonic. I don't know. I don't think it
matters.
I'm safe, right. Yeah. Well, ADA, if ADA is not. Which coefficient? Drag coefficient? That is actually not very uncertain. Because it's measured and it has actually been, it only depends on the Reynolds number logarithmically, so it's constant, more or less. So in that sense, it's not. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But whenever you have any roughness, probably the viscous drag you produce already dissipates the mole sufficiently that the mole is not unstable. That would be my argument. But yeah, one can actually do, they actually, in the same paper, they actually experiment when you have rough beds, how the numbers change and so on. It wasn't terribly different. That was my recollection. If the crust
breaks, the partial melts during the thermal runaway cycle.
Okay, the way I understand it after I talked to Lee and Ben during the commission is that if you have the pack icing, that's not saturated mode. So once you, suppose in the air condition where you have no turbulence whatsoever, once you start melting the crust and put the whole thing into melting temperature, the mole amplitude will keep on growing. In that case, it's, I can't imagine what will happen once that occurs because the heating rate rises as well. So it's not clear to me at this moment what would be the correct solution. And in that, also what I was talking about there, when the crust melts and you have this melting, this particular possibility I mentioned. This depends on the fact that the lower crust can reform during the time when the upper crust is being melted. It very much depends on that, which is not certain. So I would say once the crust melts, we don't really know what happens. Does that answer your question?
I mean, I would think that if there's enough energy in the mode to break up the crust, then it'll act very much like a young pot.
Yeah.
Down.
Yeah.
grow and develop something else.
That's right.
Nonlinear or hydro or whatever.
We saturate it. That's right. Yeah.
Nothing can stop it until it gets to the bottom.
Yeah. One just have to find another saturation mechanism and check it, whether the melting of the crust matters. Yeah.
So the question for the young neutrons are, does the lower density have a chance to grow? There's really a lot of density to grow out of the water. Or not. If it's so small, then it's going to get so much and grow.
Well, even if the crust forms and it's spinning rapidly enough, if you're above that instability point, it can still keep growing even with the crust and the boundary of it. Okay? And then it can still get big and break up the crust. So it doesn't have to get to water unit before the temperature drops to the melting. If it's spinning